This is a podcast that I've been very excited about making, and this is a guest that I've been very eager to have on my podcast and on my YouTube channel, Reverend Danny Nemu. Reverend Danny Nemu is a pioneer in the psychedelic world, and he is a great bridge for gapping shamanic knowledge, or connecting shamanic knowledge to Christianity. And we had a great little talk here, and of course, not unlike every other podcast I've done, we have all kinds of video issues and audio issues. We did this on Skype, so there was it was a little hard to do, but I think we did okay for what we were working with, and I'm a big fan of Danny. And I hope to have him back on again, and I hope you guys welcome him in warmly.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Enjoy the Place podcast. For Humans podcast. Today I got a guest that I've been excited about having. We've tried collaborating before, and we've been talking about collaborating for, I don't know, it feels like a year or something. It's been a while, so I'm excited about this one. This is, do I call you Reverend? Reverend Danny Nemu, is that what I call you?
Oh. Yep, we're back now, I think. I lost you two for a sec. Okay, I actually wasn't recording any of that, so I fucked up. Okay.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of A Place for Humans podcast. My name is Dakota, and I've got a guest today that I've been wanting to have on the podcast and wanting to have on my YouTube channel for a long time. His name is Reverend Danny Nemu, and apparently he's a real reverend, so he claims. Tell us your story. Give us a little introduction. How'd you get into the things you're into? What are you into for people that don't know?
Oh, man. I'm into most things.
Give me the rundown.
I'm into most things except cars and football. I'm a reverend, and I take that very seriously. It took me, it cost me $15. When I lived in Japan, I had five jobs. I worked in a bong shop with one of them, but on weekends I used to perform weddings dressed in my reverend's robes. And in order to do that, I needed to get ordained. So I got ordained for $15 on the internet. And I used to marry five people a day sometimes, and I used to be able to sing What a Friend You Have in Jesus in Japanese because, it's a kind of crazy industry there. So I'm a reverend in the sense that I am ordained. I'm a kind of scripture freak. What else am I into? I'm into all sorts, really. I mean, I don't know if you see my books over there. I quite like psychedelics.
Yeah, that's how I found you. So I found you when I was actually, I remember the moment I was listening to a podcast with you in it. I was in Jordan, the country of Jordan. I was just traveling along by myself. I rented a car, driving all around the country. I had just left the Dead Sea, so I'm driving along this road with the Dead Sea next to me on my way to the Moses Memorial. And I don't know. I'm into the mystical side of spirituality, like psychedelics and stuff like that. And I knew Moses was a mystic, or at least appeared to be a mystic from the things that I could gather, you know, with like the burning bush and stuff. So I was going to visit and pay my respects to the Moses Memorial. And that's how I found out about you. So I was just Googling like psychedelics in the Bible and stuff like that. And you popped up. And here we are.
I mean, Moses. Let's talk about Moses, man. Moses is an interesting dude. I just published this article, when was it? About a couple of months ago, in the Journal of Psychedelic Studies. And it's the first, probably the last peer-reviewed kind of academic journal I published. But it starts off looking at Moses as a shaman. And I'm kind of drawing on this paper by Winkelmann, Michael Winkelmann, his name is. He wrote a book called Shamanism, but in 2013, he surveyed these 47 different traditional societies looking at magico-religious practitioners, basically shamans, and he finds a group of motifs that you see in all of these different cultures. And I've just got them here, actually. I'll just read them out to you. A dominant social role as the preeminent charismatic leader, a nighttime community ritual, use of chanting, singing, drumming and dancing, initiatory crisis involving death and rebirth, shamanic training involving the induction of an altered state of consciousness, particularly with fasting and social isolation, altered states of consciousness characterized the soul journey, visionary experiences, divination, diagnosis, prophecy, healing, illness believed to be caused by spirits and sorcerers, and animal relations as a source of power, including controlling animals and transforming into animals, malevolent acts of sorcery, including the ability to kill, and hunting magic, and assistance in acquiring for food. So I was looking at these tropes in the Bible, and pretty much all of them except for one, is in the stories of Moses or his sister, the prophetess Miriam, or his brother. I guess one that is there obliquely is he doesn't actually turn into an animal, but there's times when his rod turns into an animal. But you've got, I mean, all the others, you've got, you know, the killing of the firstborn, for example, the hunting magic. There's the ability to find, he finds water, for example, in his divination. He also finds food, healing, divination, altered states of consciousness. All of these tropes are found in the stories of Moses. Use of chanting, singing and drumming. And, you know, he introduces three nighttime rituals as well. So I thought that was pretty nuts that he so clearly fitted the bill of a shaman.
Yes. I mean, outside of the story of Moses, do we get any of these other kind of people like this in this area? Like, is there a culture of shamanism in this area prior to Moses?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Like, the one shamanic trope, which isn't, which he doesn't hit, actually, is this thing, the experience of a soul journey. So the kind of traditional shamanic soul journey when you play your drum or do whatever you do and then go off on a journey. So Moses doesn't actually do that. Moses, it says in the Bible, he talks to Yahweh face to face as a man talks to his friend. But the other ones do that. Like Enoch, for example, there's this line about Enoch and it says, and Enoch walked with Elohim and he was not, for Elohim took him. So you've got this kind of idea of him disappearing from where he is and not being there anymore, being taken on a journey. So they did have these other tropes in other biblical figures. But Moses is kind of like a super prophet or a super shaman. So he doesn't need to do the soul journey. He just gets to talk to his friend.
Right. So what kind of culture is there prior to Moses as far as shamanic cultures go?
Oh, right.
Or, you know, prior to Christianity or...
In that area, I mean, that's an interesting question. We don't have... Like, in terms of those kind of tropes, what have we got? You've got archaeological evidence from, from at least the 14th century BC, and the stories of Moses were written down in probably 10th century BC. Whether he was actually around or not is a kind of a question that's up for debate. But his stories are first written in the 14th century, in the 10th century BC. The finding of cannabis in quite near Jerusalem in forms which are both smokable and kind of suggesting transdermal application, like basically rubbing on your skin, which is what happens in the Bible with the anointing oil. And so there's archaeological evidence for that. But further back than that, I mean, you've got the Canaanite religion. They worshipped Baal, but I'm not entirely sure. I mean, no, they did it with frankincense, so they were using psychoactive, right. Psychoactive stuff. But the details of those religions, I don't think we know all that much about. Actually, no, we do know something, because there was a snake worshipping cult in the northern part of the Holy Land. Because there's bits about I guess kind of complex, but there's two documents that go into the Bible, and one of them, they seem to have a snake worshipping cult going on. So that seems pretty.
Yeah, shamanic. What's up with the snake and this reoccurring symbol of the snake? Do you know anything about this? It seems to be such a reoccurring theme in all traditions, regardless of being shamanic traditions or not. Specifically in shamanic traditions, it seems. But I mean, in the Bible, you got this symbol of the serpent. And you know, something I just found out that was really interesting is that Zeus was actually a serpent before becoming Zeus. Did you know that?
No,
he was originally. Yeah, I read that in a book called The Cosmic Serpent. If you've read that book or not, it's a really good book by Jeremy Narby.
Yeah, I know the book. I don't remember that bit.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, if you look at the Hindu tradition, there's a kind of pre-god called Ananta, He's a snake with one body and 1,000 heads, and he out of this Ananta, which actually means zero in terms of like Hindu mathematics, the word means zero. He kind of sits there in the primal sea. So yeah, it all kind of traces back to snakes. I think something interesting about snakes is that, you know, they're built. The fear of snakes is built into us on a very, very deep level. If you show if you keep a certain birds, I think it's ostriches, but basically if you keep birds in isolation and never show them a snake, and then show them something which looks like a snake, they instinctively attack it. So I think part of it is we've got a very instinctive relationship with snakes, but also, you know, it's in terms of its symbolism, it's fantastic because it's obviously it's quite phallic looking. It's also kind of slithery and quite it's got that kind of wave thing going on, which is perhaps more feminine. And it's got the power to kill, and it also sheds its skin, which is quite a nice image of transformation.
Yeah, it is, but it's just so interesting to me that it's found in such foreign cultures that, I mean, would otherwise be kind of alien to each other, still have this symbol of the serpent. It seems like, I mean, I guess from an evolutionary perspective, it kind of makes sense that we would kind of have some powerful serpent figure, but it seems almost too coincidental how often it's found.
Mm.
What, maybe you can explain what the serpent means in like the story of Genesis or something like that. What's some of the symbology?
Yeah, I'd like to do that, actually. He's so all we know about the snake is this line from I think it's the last line of Genesis 2. No, it's the first line of Genesis 3, and it says, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made." So a super interesting line for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it doesn't necessarily mean that Yahweh Elohim made the snake. Like, it's ambiguous both in the Hebrew and the English as to whether the snake was there before Yahweh Elohim, who's the kind of first God name that puts his foot on the planet, who appears. So there's a kind of an implication, or there's a way of reading that line that says that the snake was already there before everything else arrived, including Yahweh Elohim, which is quite interesting because, like I say, in the Hindu, before the creation of the world, before Brahma, before anything, you already have this snake. And
same with the Aztec traditions. You have Quetzalcoatl.
He's there before creation, is he?
Sort of. It's the stem of creation.
Yeah, that's super interesting because this thing about the in the Hindu tradition again, Ananta's got one body but 1,000 heads. So you can see this idea of sort of coming from a point into all. And actually, it kind of relates. I think it relates to the Hebrew letter Aleph, which means both one and 1,000 as well. But back to that line, right, the serpent was more subtle. If you go to the previous verse, which is Genesis, the last verse of Genesis 2, it says, "And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." And then the next line is, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which Yahweh Elohim had made." Now that word naked, which describes the innocence of Adam and Eve in Genesis 2:25, is arom. In Hebrew, arom, right? And then the word for subtle, which describes what we tend to think of as the kind of evilness of the snake, or certainly the sneakiness of the snake, is arom in Hebrew. And if you look on a scroll, actually, one is written like immediately above. So the words are right next to each other, basically. And they're spelt in Hebrew in exactly the same way. You can't tell between them. And the pronunciation of the Bible, right, of the Old Testament, it was fixed in the 7th century AD. So you already had, like, I mean, that story would have been like well over 1,000 years old by the time somebody decided how, well, it was the Masoretes, decided exactly how it was meant to be pronounced. But before that, you have all these different traditions of pronunciation, you know, so, and the way that you pronounce words influences, or the word changes completely the meaning of it in order, according to how you pronounce it. So, like, in the... There's a line about the, there's a midrash, basically from the Talmud. It says that there's 70 faces of the Torah, which means that there's 70 different ways you can read each verse, right? So that line, I find it fascinating. The nakedness of Adam and Eve is the same word as the subtleness of the snake. And then you hear it again because Adam gets asked by Yahweh Elohim, he says, why did you hide? And he says, I hid because I was, and he uses the same word again, which is naked, but it also means subtle, as in sneaky, and it also means prudent. And then you get into like Proverbs, the book of Proverbs, that same word appears, I think it's 18 times or something like that. And every time it's a virtue, it's never a vice, yeah? So we have this idea that the snake is a bad guy, but he only gets one adjective in the entire Bible. He only gets one word describing him in the entire Bible. And that word is a kind of a word which can mean prudent or naked or subtle. Yahweh, for example, gets described as evil in various verses. So we have this idea that the snake's the good guy and the other guy's the bad guy. Yahweh's the bad guy, but it's not from the text. That's from tradition that comes later.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you can explain some about Yahweh, because Yahweh, they were communicating with Yahweh through kind of the same means that shamans kind of invoke different spirits, maybe in the Amazon, or even like we were talking about before we got on the podcast, of these Mazatec Indians, or these Mazatec people in Mexico. They invoke all kinds of spirits using the mushroom or through different types of lighting incense and mantra and chanting and stuff like that. And it seems like the same thing is being expressed in these stories with Yahweh, maybe because they were using certain things to invoke the voice of Yahweh, right? Or Moses was.
Yeah, exactly. So Moses was. The other prophets who also speak to Yahweh, they don't do that. So you get some of them who will use like asana, they'll use certain positions. Some of them will fast. Some of them will kind of practice sexual abstinence. Some of them will go to special places. Some of them meet Yahweh when they're unhappy. Like, there's a bunch of different reasons, or in dreams, or whatever it might be. So, like, specifically, we're talking about the priestly caste who encounter Yahweh with in the tabernacle. And this is what my kind of recently published article is about all the various different drugs that are used in the tabernacle. So, and Moses himself, when he first encounters Yahweh, I don't think he's taking anything. There's no reason to believe that he is taking anything. But when, like for example, the priestly line, they all are obliged to be anointed with a particular oil, and if they and the line goes like this, they should be anointed that they can minister unto me, and it's Yahweh speaking. So without having this oil experience, then they're not allowed to minister. They're not allowed to be priests. There's another line where King David, but all the kings had this anointing experience as well. And there's this line where, I wonder if I've got it here. No, I don't think I've got it here. But it says something along this, Samuel, and it says, he anointed David, and from that day forward, the spirit of Yahweh was upon David. So the oil is very specifically used to introduce people to Yahweh, specifically the priests and the king. And both of those roles, the priest and the king, are where the tribe is kind of the, let's say, the hinge point or the opening point between the tribe and the deity, in this case, Yahweh. So what would happen, so this oil contains four ingredients. It contains cinnamon, cassia, myrrh, and caner bosim, which is, I mean, we can go into it later, but that's very likely to be cannabis. So all the priests had this put upon them, and then the normal priests would go off and they'd eat something called showbread, which is quite interesting in itself. But then the high priest would then go to the back of the tabernacle, having this oil put upon him. And maybe I'll just explain the oil a little bit. The oil's got a wide range of enzyme inhibitors. In fact, if you take like cinnamon and cassia together, they're both different forms of the cinnamon plant, or different species, let's say. Cassia inhibits one of the five cytochrome enzymes which breaks down drugs, and cinnamon inhibits the other four, right? So we're getting quite complicated quite quickly. I hope I'm not going too fast here, but in the same way that ayahuasca has an enzyme inhibitor, which is either harmine or harmaline or beta-carbolines, which allows the DMT to get to your brain, like, because it's a mixture of two plants, right? If you just eat DMT on its own, it won't do anything to you because it doesn't get into your brain. But if you inhibit your enzymes, then that DMT can, it doesn't get broken down, it ends up in your brain. So in the same way, the cytochrome system, which breaks down most drugs, gets inhibited by cinnamon and cassia. The oil has also got cannabis and myrrh in it, and myrrh's full of opioid receptor, works on the same system as opium and heroin and things like that. And then what happens is the high priest himself would go alone into a chamber in the back of the tabernacle. And the chamber is 4.5 meter cubed square, right? So it's like a small box, and it's very tightly sealed. You know, the way that the tabernacle is described, it's described in intricate detail in the book of Exodus. It gets 5 chapters, basically.
Were they moving it around?
So that's the story. It's a tent that was moved around. The tent, it has like a kind of acacia frame, and then it's got like 4 different types of material. So it's got 2 which go straight down the side of this acacia frame, and then they're pinned into the ground. And then it's got 2 which kind of act as a windbreak outside it. And the most outside one is a super thick leather. It was used to make shoes, for example. So what they get in, what you have when this is made, is a smoke box, like a kind of a hot box, basically. And it's and the veil at the front of it, I'm talking about the back chamber of the tabernacle here, the veil is described in the time of the temple as the thickness of a man's hand, right? So you've got this super fat veil which completely seals a 4.5 meter chamber. And in there, there's only one object, which is the magic box, the Ark of the Covenant, or maybe the Ark of the Alliance would be another word. You know how you hear about shamans making alliances with their allies,
yeah,
with their spirit allies. So the word covenant also means alliance. And the only other thing that was allowed to be taken into that room was a censer, like an incense burner, and handfuls of resins, finely ground resins. And these resins, you know, they contain, I'll give you a list here, it's like myrrh, cassia, spikenard, which boosts dopamine and boosts GABA and boosts a whole lot of stuff in your brain. Saffron, costus, they're both related to ecstasy. What else have you got? You've got onica, you've got galbanum, which works on the GABA system, which is the same system that Valium works on. Frankincense, which is packed full of kind of interesting psychoactives. And basically, so they go back into this, the high priest would go alone into this chamber, burn loads and loads of smoke, and then sit there in this box and talk to the angels and have visions. And then he'd come out with the results of his divination, you know, which is very much the shamanic, what shamanism was used for and still is used for, actually, in the jungle.
Right.
You know, divination, particularly on areas of health and areas of military kind of strategy. When do we attack the enemy tribe? Because the shaman's job is to protect his tribe, both from disease from the inside and also from like enemy movements, and also to find water and to find game. So you see all of those 3 tropes in what Moses does.
So how many gods are there of the Old Testament? Were they only communicating with Yahweh, or is there multiple beings they're communicating with?
Yeah, so this depends on who you ask, right? So most modern day Jews and Christians would say it's one God.
Yeah.
If you go back to the time when it was written, or rather the verses that are still in the Bible now, you get lines like, I think it's Jethro says, "Now I know that Yahweh is mightier than all the gods of Egypt," right? And that's not monotheism, that's paganism. Or they call it monolatry, which is, it's kind of like, let's say, a monogamous paganism, where you know there are other gods, but you just select one and you worship that one, right? Having said that, you've then got, I think it's about 60 different names of God. Yeah, like, you know, Yahweh is the Lord. Then you've got the Lord of Hosts, for example, it's the kind of the weaponized one, like the Lord of Armies, basically. And you've got Yahweh Rapha, which is the Lord of Cure. You've got El Shaddai, for example, which is the one that Abraham encounters. And his personality is completely different. So the story of Abraham is really indicative in this aspect, because, like, El Shaddai, or someone who presents himself as El Shaddai, says to Abraham, "Go and sacrifice your son, Isaac." And so Abraham prepares the sacrifice, and he's taking Isaac up the hill. And then when he draws the knife, an angel of Yahweh comes to him and says, "Don't sacrifice your son." So you've got 2 different gods saying different things, and Abraham has to choose which one he's going to follow. Yeah. So, I mean, this is the subject of my second book, which is called Neuroapocalypse, is looking at these different god names as different different aspects of psychology, or different aspects of neurology, in fact. So what I believe is that El Shaddai is the reptilian brain, because reptiles do actually sacrifice their children. They snakes will eat baby snakes if they can catch them, you know. But mammals don't do that.
So you think
Yahweh comes along?
You think that's an expression? You think that's an expression of some ancient part of our evolution, or you think this is an archetype?
I think that people who learn to navigate their own inner space, right, whether that's through the breath or whether that's through psychoactives or something, can access different parts of their own mind. I mean, a friend of mine, for example, was studying quite a martial form of Tai Chi, and he said his teacher used to would demonstrate how to go back into the reptilian reptilian part of the mind, and then he would fight from that particular zone, right? So that's what I think. Yeah, I think you've got access to these various different zones, and they have very different flavors. So, for example, Yahweh is the God who's interested in the tribe and loving your brothers and sisters and loving your tribe, but hating your enemy. And that's very much an aspect of basically oxytocin. Oxytocin makes you, it's considered the love, it's what makes us love, but it also makes us hate others. There's been some experiments, and like really kind of quite chilling experiments from Holland about if you give someone oxytocin, they're kind of more likely to, basically they're more likely to discriminate against people who they don't consider from their tribe, like people with Islamic names, for example. So oxytocin kind of brings us together, but also pushes enemies away. So Yahweh, the sacrifice that he demands from Moses is that you shouldn't boil a baby goat in its mother's milk, boil a kid in its mother's milk, which is why Jews don't eat milk and meat together, right? And that is a representation of the love between a mother and a child, which is something that snakes don't have and, reptiles don't have. When El Shaddai is speaking, he's talking about territory and procreation and survival, right? When Yahweh's speaking, he's not talking about those things. He's talking about tribal unity. He says, I will give you the land. And he's concentrating on the other tribes. I'll give you the land of this tribe and that tribe, and you can have this land, right?
So do you think these are... I don't know what your experience is. I know you've been to the jungle and you've done some shamanic journeying and stuff like that. And have you had these experiences of coming in contact with these kind of external intelligences or sort of spirit beings or whatever people want to call them, demons, angels, godlike voices? Because an interesting experience I've had on psychedelics, which is really... this experience of communicating with something that presents itself as the other is what's kind of kept me on the path of spirituality, kind of, because it's shown me that there is something more. And whether or not that something more is just, lurking in the shadows of myself, I mean, who knows what it is, but it's an interesting experience to have. And I mean, what is your experience with this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of question. Is it inside? Is it outside? Definitely there's it feels like there's intelligences which are not mine influencing me when I'm working with ayahuasca, for example. I guess the proof, what I find fascinating, is when those things come along and they give you a bit of information which then turns out to be true, like where you've lost something, where your keys are, or for example, my wife dug up all this buried glass that had been buried like in the 1970s. It had been sitting there for this is about 10 years ago, so it had been sitting there for about 40 years in a particular part of this community in the Amazon. So when you get kind of confirmation from outside, I find that really, really interesting. Whether they're inside or whether they're outside, who knows? That's quite a big question.
I mean, yeah, it kind of goes to whether this is inside or outside also, right? There was a...
Well, I mean, it's inside, isn't it?
Well,
I'm hearing your voice.
Yeah, yeah, of course. But
through
there was
my neuro.
An Indian sage who said inside and outside mean the same thing or nothing at all because they imply each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of
like
kind of one experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it like this, for example, you're communicating to me now through are through my ears and my neurobiology. Yeah, the spirits communicate to me through my neurobiology. You know, so how am I to? It seems almost discriminatory to distinguish you as more valid than them, because I mean, both of you are communicating through my brain.
All right. So maybe you can can give me kind of the rundown of your experience being in the Amazon and working with ayahuasca.
So I mean, I started drinking daimi in Japan.
Okay.
So, and that was what, 18, 19 years ago now. Yeah, a long time ago. So I drank there for 5 years when I was living there. Lived there for 6 years, drank for 5 years there. And then I left and I came back to England, and then I spent about a year and a half here, and then I went to go live in the Amazon. And I went there specifically with two goals in mind. One was to finish writing my book, and the second one was to learn about the power of ayahuasca, let's say. And I hadn't been there very long. I'd only been there a few months when I got, you know, I was having quite a good time. You know, I was cutting ayahuasca vine and making ayahuasca and drinking a whole load, living in the jungle, in this community. And I got bitten by a sandfly, which is a type of, well, it's a fly. And this fly, the bite turned into a pimple, and the pimple was on my chest. The pimple kind of grew and grew and grew until it became this like massive ulcer, like pussy, nasty thing. And the people around me said, man, you've got leishmaniasis, or leishmaniosa in Portuguese. It's kind of a lovely word in Portuguese. And it's a flesh-eating colony, a cousin of leprosy. And they all kind of flipped out. They said, man, you've got to go and have injections. You need to take antimonium tartrate, because this can, the second stage, digests the cartilage in your nose and your ears and your throat and your wherever you have cartilage, right? So that's the second form of leishmaniasis. So you know, as I said, I'd gone out there for a specific reason, which was to learn about the power of ayahuasca and to write the book. And the book, with a lot of it, was about medicine, history of medicine, which is my degree at university was in history of medicine. And it gave me a very good opportunity to actually test out if ayahuasca was what it was. When I say ayahuasca, I should be a bit more clear. I'm talking about daimi here, because daimi is a particular lineage of ayahuasca. In a certain format and taken in a certain way, with quite a lot of discipline and, let's say, protocols as to how to take it. My path has been with daimi. So I decided, actually what I did was I drank a dose. I didn't know what to do. Everyone was saying, listen, you've got to go. If you go today to the hospital, you can have maybe 80 injections. If you leave it till tomorrow, it's going to be 120 injections. If you leave it till later, it could be 230 injections. And the injections are of antimonium tartrate, which is a heavy metal, man. And I hadn't taken any pharmaceuticals since I was about 16 at that point, and I was already kind of in my, let's say, mid to late 20s by that point. And I really didn't want to take it. But everyone was saying, you're going to lose your nose if you don't, because they don't believe that you can treat that disease with that medicine. And like I say, that my degree was in this kind of stuff. So I'd studied how Ayurveda had been pushed out by interventionist pharmaceutical medicine. I studied this kind of stuff all over the world, and I've seen the same thing happening at the kind of border between the jungle and the city in Rio Branco in Brazil, just by the Bolivian border. So I drank a dose. And I asked what I should do, and I got I had a series of visions, and the visions were of all the people who'd come up to me and said, look, I had this disease, look at my scars, I took these injections, you've got to take these injections. And all of them still had something wrong with them. Like, one of them had these weird bumps on his legs, and one of them had all his joints were painful because antimonium attacks your joints. One of them was like just pig ignorant and clearly hadn't learned anything. And this other side of the disease kind of revealed itself. And, you know, in esoteric perspective on disease, like Manly P. Hall talks about this, and other people as well. But when you go out of balance is where you get hit by a disease, right? In Chinese medicine, for example, when you go to treat a disease, they kind of put your meridians back into balance, right? So I didn't think this disease was... I mean, it was external, back to this question of external and internal. I thought that it had come because there was something that I needed fortifying in myself. And I wasn't going to fortify it with heavy metals. I was going to fortify it with daimi. And also, it fit very beautifully into the trajectory of the story which I was busy writing, and I'm a bit of a sucker for plot lines. So I decided I wasn't going to take these injections, and I was just going to drink daimi. So I drank loads and loads of daimi under the tutelage of a curandero, Padrino Nonato, his name is. And so at one point I was drinking every day for about 4 or 5 months, drinking at 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, it was crazy, man. I lost 10 kilos. I've got a really good scar. I lost a... I kind of had an ex-wife who had come back into my life, and then I lost her, and then I lost these rose-coloured spectacles which had been stuck on my face for far too long. You know, I lost a whole load of stuff that I didn't need, and, you know, ayahuasca is about purging, getting rid of stuff that you don't need, so it did a real number on me, and I came out quite a different person, I think.
And it cured you of the leprosy, cousin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
And a whole lot more.
Yeah, and a whole lot more. Yeah, that's interesting. So what is what's the difference between like a traditional ayahuasca sort of tradition versus the one that you were, the daime that you were a part of?
Yeah, so daime arose in the 1920s, around then, right? So it has a whole, 100 years of tradition.
Yeah.
Before that, you have the... you have the various indigenous and mestizo traditions, and most of them, in fact, I think pretty much all of them, shamanism involves someone going off on their own to the jungle for 6 months or 10 months or a year, practicing sexual abstinence, usually like having dietas, like taking a plant over and over again, sometimes drinking ayahuasca. But different tribes do it differently, but, you know, some of them will say that you don't change your clothes for the entire time. You know, the foods that you eat are very restricted. And so when we talk about, like, when people talk about the shamanic experience or a shamanic ceremony, it's nothing like actual shamanism was, let's say 100 years ago. You know, people didn't get together to drink ayahuasca. The shaman would drink ayahuasca on your behalf and then come back with a diagnosis for you. You say, okay, you've got this thing because, you know, somebody, you betrayed somebody, whatever, you have to overcome it by eating this plant and doing whatever it might be, burying all kinds of things they could say, some kind of magic. So what Mestre Ireneo, who is the founder of my lineage, of Daimi, did was he was a border guard, actually a very tall black man from the other side of Brazil, from Maranhão, from the coast on the Nordeste, the eastern coast, went over all the way to the other side of the country, and he was seeking his fortune when the rubber boom happened, right? And he was working as a border guard, he encountered some Indians, probably from the Huniquin tribe, and they taught him how to use ayahuasca. And then he was working as a curandero. He was treating people, including treating some of his enemies, in a traditional manner. So he was using icaros, and he was shaking his maraca. But his own kind of lineage, let's say, developed into a slightly different style, which was a communal ritual. So everyone would drink, and then everyone started playing. One day he said, everyone's going to play maraca, which is like the percussion instrument, like a maraca. You say in English, say maraca. I'm just going to close the door because my family just arrived and they're loud.
No problem.
He kind of took it out of the jungle into an urban and like kind of Catholic context. So the influences into daimi are folk Catholicism, some influence from the kind of spiritist tradition in Europe, and indigenous animism.
So what's the most kind of supernatural thing you've experienced? Because I've heard some of these shamans can have, like I was reading, I think in this same book I was talking about, the Cosmic Serpent book, it was talking about shamans being able to shoot astral darts and stuff like that through their hands and this kind of thing. Have you seen any of this? Have you experienced any of this during your shamanic exploration?
Yeah, it's kind of difficult because in Brazil, in this tradition, they say if you share your visions, you will lose your visions, and so, you know, in a kind of more either a therapeutic setting, we kind of had this idea that you should share your dreams and you should share this and share that, which may make sense in a kind of therapeutic setting. And you know, if you take acid and you go and see a band and you encounter, I don't know, whatever you might encounter, it might be appropriate to share it. but there's not a whole lot of what I've seen that I would really want to share.
Right.
And there's a number of reasons for that. Like, it's an occult thing. It happens within in like a kind of crucible, and I don't really want to invite to. Yeah, like I'm not in the habit of sharing wisdom. But I will tell you one thing. I had one session where I got visited, I think, by a celebrity magician, or quite a famous magician from the kind of early 20th century. And I said during the session, I said, look, what are you doing here? This isn't your lineage. And furthermore, I don't do celebrity mediumship. And I was sent this guy away. And immediately after the session, somebody came up to me and started talking to me about that particular magician. And this was the only time in like 18 years that a Brazilian has come up to me and talked to me about that guy, which I thought was quite weird. And then, you know, we ate some food and whatever, a whole load of stuff happened. And then later on, I got a lift home with another guy. And this other guy also brought up this same magician. So two people kind of mentioning this guy's name after he'd popped up in a session. That was quite weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you consider someone like Aleister Crowley, would you consider him to be a shaman?
Three times. Yeah, so that's an interesting dude, isn't it? He certainly had access to the spirits. He practiced divination. He did magic for healing. He did magic for a lot of these things. He would have called himself a gentleman. I don't know if he would have called himself a shaman. You know, it's a complicated term, right? You know, I've got a good friend, Julian Vane, and his definition of shaman is the guy with a hat who also has the drugs. I mean, while I quite like the definition, it's certainly not what a shaman is in Brazil. They don't actually use that word. They say pajé.
Yeah.
In Brazil.
Yeah.
The
in
term
Mexico,
comes from
in Mexico. They call them tepapoques.
Right. Yeah. So the thing about it's like this: if you practice divination amongst your tripping, then yeah, I think you can probably call yourself a shaman. If you've done the dietas, if you've done the practice, all kind of stuff like that. I keep meeting people who've, you know, spent 3 weeks in the jungle and they're dishing out psychedelics to people, and they're calling themselves shamans. And it's certainly the meaning of the term has drifted a long way, right? You know, Terence McKenna was in some way responsible for this. You know, he kind of talked about the shaman in a way that no anthropologist in their right mind would.
Yeah, so have you ever had any of these kind of experiences outside of taking psychedelics, like maybe through some kind of different method or, you know, like some of these, especially like European traditions, talk about like looking into mirrors or this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I've messed around in some circles here and there. I've stared into the odd mirror. I was in a Buddhist tradition for a couple of years. I've just got an article coming out on a book on Three Hands Press called Daimon and Pharmacon, and that's talking about Goetia, as in the magic of Solomon the King, working with some of the spirits of his, like the Lesser Key of Solomon. I've been interested in the occult since at least someone taught me a spell when I was about 21. This dude, I had blue hair, and this other guy at my university also had blue hair, and so we got talking, and it turned, and he kind of taught me a spell, and I laughed in his face because I didn't think the world worked like that, and I tried it out, and it worked, and I tried it out again, and it worked again, and then I got really interested. I started reading lots of Aleister Crowley, for example, and some other occultists, and ended up getting myself a tarot deck, and the kind of information that came out of that was so basically the answer to your question is yeah, I've been into this stuff well before I got into ayahuasca, let's say.
Yeah, same with me too. I remember reading or trying to read Aleister Crowley books when I was a kid, and they were a bit too dense for me, and I'm actually a little keen to get back into them. But I remember that's the first time I've heard of sort of spirit invocation through plants when I was a kid, and it was through Aleister Crowley reading something he's done. I think he was contacting some sort of gray-looking being. Lamb, maybe his name was, or something like this.
It's Lamb. I mean, he's very complex. A good starter, a good book to read of his, or a book with his stuff in it, is called A Portable Darkness. And it's got an introduction by Genesis P. Orridge and Rob Anton Wilson. It looks at him as primarily a linguistic philosopher. And it has a kind of anthology of his writings, and then like an introduction from this guy. It's a beautiful and brilliant book. Because his writing's really dense, man. Really, really, really complicated. But fascinating, dude. Like, completely fascinating.
So have you successfully ever invoked a sort of, maybe a psychedelic state through one of those other methods?
I actually do this quite often in other people. Like, my day job is a hypnotherapist. And I gave a talk at Brompton Cemetery just down the road the other day, on Sunday. And it was about hypnotism and the links between hypnotism and the occult in history. Looking at kind of Victorian occultists and stuff. But whilst I was doing it, I was also kept on like putting the audience in and out of trance. And the final thing that I did was I kind of got them into a state where they would encounter a spirit animal, and then got them to turn into the spirit animal. So I got them to feel what it was like to have this animal overtake them. And in fact, Jeremy Narby, I can't remember if he tells this story in the Cosmic Trigger, or if he just told this story in one of the times I've seen him. But he tells a story about taking tobacco paste and then feeling how his teeth become, I think it's a jaguar, but he starts to notice that his teeth have become spiky, and he's getting really kind of hungry and thinking in a slightly different way. So, I mean, you can induce states actually quite easily. It just requires a bit of perseverance.
Do you think that's kind of what magic is, or on like maybe a surface level, is kind of this hypnotic sort of trance state that maybe culture or intentionally corporations and stuff sort of invoke or cast upon us? You think that's kind of what we're experiencing in life?
I think the techniques of magic often involve trance. Yeah, like if you look at an occult ritual to work with the energies of Venus, for example, it's going to have the number 7 somewhere in it. It's going to have the colour green somewhere in it. So you might have, say, 7 green candles. Like, Kabbalistically, those are the numbers and colours of Venus. It's going to have some rose incense in it somewhere. It's going to have probably the kind of invocation the invocatory language is going to be poetic to evoke that kind of feeling. And the direction of it is going to be some kind of a love spell. So all of the, let's say, all of the senses, and also all of the stuff you've learned about magic, is all focused down to a point. And that's how trance happens, when you focus everything to one particular point. However, that's the technique of magic. The actual, let's say, the action of magic, which is to cause, and I think Crowley's definition is the best, to cause change in accordance with your consciousness. No. There's all kinds of mysteries that happen, and yeah, like they happen in your head, but they also happen outside your head, and that's the curious thing.
Well, do you think, because when I hear things like that, I always think of advertising, and I think of the way that these companies will sort of invoke feelings of insecurity or something like that, or invoke sort of some kind of family emotional feeling, and then attach that to a product which means absolutely nothing or something like that. Would you consider that kind of a basic form of magic?
Yeah, it's a pretty low form. Yeah, I'm more into kind of, you know, making your neighbor's cow produce sour milk and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I'm old
that's
school
cool.
about magic. I mean, the same guy I mentioned, Julian Vane, he was recently asked to do a talk it was a keynote presentation, I think, at some kind of advertising convention or something like that. So yeah, they're right onto sigil magic. Those guys know what they're doing, you know. They've been doing it for a long, long time.
Did you ever watch the Joe Rogan podcast?
Sometimes, yeah.
Did you watch the one with Alex Jones talking about these governments taking DMT and making interdimensional deals with these demonic entities?
I think I remember Joe's face just kind of looking at him in horror. Yeah, no, I can't listen to Alex Jones for more than about 3 minutes.
Yeah, I kind of like the idea that something mystical like that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, like, if we look at the British Empire came straight out of the ideas of John Dee. You know, he predicted it and then kind of created it out of a tiny little island nation that didn't really have very much. So yeah, I mean, magic's powerful. I mean, if you go to the British Museum, you can see the obsidian disc which he used to scry into, and there's also a talisman that he produced in order to scupper the Spanish Armada. You know, when the Spanish Armada came to England, it got wiped out by a storm on the way.
I'm just now starting to learn about John Dee and this kind of magic stuff deeper. What do you think about John Marco Allegro and his kind of conclusion about what the Dead Sea Scrolls say?
I think as a scholar, I think he kind of, you know, he clearly knew what he was talking about in terms of the languages. I think he opened the door to another way of thinking about scripture. I don't think Jesus was a mushroom. What's the guy's name? Thomas Hatzis has pretty much demolished, I think, the argument about, as far as I'm concerned, about mushrooms in the Bible. Because, I mean, A, there aren't any. Like, if you want to find drugs in the Bible, there's stacks of drugs in the Bible, but there aren't any mushrooms. There's no mushrooms in the letters between mystics at the time, and they were talking about the drugs they were using. This wasn't a taboo subject back in the day. So, I mean, where's the evidence? The evidence is like, what's this other book? The Psychedelic Gospels, which has come out recently. Man, if you're finding like half a mushroom in a stained glass window in medieval
Europe.
Church in France.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it might be evidence of a mushroom cult that grew up at some point later, but no, I don't really buy it.
Well,
I find
the timelines of these churches to be interesting. You know, it's late 50, or I think early 1500s is when you really start seeing these mushroom art popping up in these churches around Europe, and that's around the time that the Spanish was colonizing, you know, like Mexico, for example, where there's a lot of mushroom use, and there is mushroom use in Europe too. So I'm not going to downplay the fact that it could be inspired from that, but I do find it interesting that the timeline is right around, you know, the colonization of these.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it makes a lot of sense that there were mushroom cults. You know, when people encounter interesting cultures and interesting psychoactives, I mean, Daimi would be an example. The syncretism between Catholicism and ayahuasca is very, very vibrant. You know, it reinvigorates the tradition. So yeah, you definitely want to incorporate it. I just don't think it's there at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, you don't really see too much evidence for it. So what do you think? Like something in like manna in the Book of Exodus. What's your sort of explanation for that?
Yeah, this might get a bit involved. So, I think it's ergot. So, yeah, that's as close as we get to mushroom, because it's a fungus. Right, manna is described... there's a couple of things about manna, right? One of the things is that there's one line in the entire Bible where you see synesthesia, right? Where you see a sound is seen. You get this line, and all the people were seeing the sound of the trumpets. And you don't normally see, you know, you don't normally see that kind of thing unless you're tripping. So it's just, that's the only synesthesia in the Bible. It's also the only collective revelation in the Bible. They're all the kind of Israelites are all around Mount Sinai, and they all see this together, and they also see the mountain. It's burning with a fire that doesn't consume. So it burns but doesn't consume. And if you think about what the world looks like when you're on acid or something like that, it's quite often got these crazy, very colourful geometric patterns around the object of your attention. You know, so if you didn't have the language, you might call them flames that burned but didn't consume. Right? Another thing about that scene is it's all of the Israelites eating manna together. Right? So from the, let's say, the phenomenology of the text, from the experience that they're having, it looks like they're tripping. If you look at manna itself, it resembles ergot in pretty much all of its pretty much everything. Like, for example, the taste of it is described as the taste of honey, which is what ergot secretion does actually taste like. It's described as kind of pellet size, like pellets the size of coriander, and they're white. And I've actually got some frankincense here, but it looks pretty similar. You know, when ergot secretion comes off the plant, it makes like you can see one there. I'll find a white one. This is a frankincense, but it makes little pellets that sit on the plant, or it drops onto the ground. Yeah, and when it drops onto the ground, it splashes, because it's not viscous. It splashes into a kind of it makes a kind of frost. And the other way that ergot is described, sorry, the other way that manna is described, is like a frost that was on the ground, right? And then there's this other thing about the fact of when it's found. It's found in spring in the Bible, which is when ergot comes out of its dormancy. It's only found where there is vegetation. It's not found when there's no water. They don't find any ergot. They don't find any manna. And I guess another thing which is quite interesting is that Moses says to the Israelites, don't leave any of this until tomorrow. And some of them do leave it until tomorrow, and they find that it stinks and it's got worms in it and it's rotted. And rapid rotting, it doesn't happen to any of the other secretions in the desert. There are other secretions in the desert, but it is a function. It is one of the factors of the ergot secretion. It rapidly rots and it becomes toxic. And there's just a couple of more things about why I think it's manna. It can be ground. Like the production of manna, the way you use it in the Bible, is first it's ground and then it's boiled and then it's baked, right? And when Albert Hofmann used ergot to make LSD, right? Ergot contains LSA, which is a cousin of LSD. It has quite similar effects, but it's toxic. If you take it on its own, ergot is toxic. But if you grind it up and then boil it, it separates into two fractions. It separates into a water-soluble fraction and a non-soluble fraction. The non-soluble fraction has the poison in it. If you get rid of that and you're left with the soluble fraction, and then you bake it, i.e. you put it in the oven or whatever, and you end up with crystals which contain LSA, which are mind-blowingly powerful crystals. And, you know, manna, we get this idea that manna is like kind of, you know, food aid dropping out of the sky. But in fact, it's not. There's two foods that are given in the Bible. One is quails, which kind of drop out of the sky, and that's the meat that they eat. You've got this line in the evenings you shall eat meat, and in the morning you are satisfied with manna. And manna is one of the two things that they eat in the Bible. It's a secretion, and in that line which I just said, it's the manna which gives satisfaction. So the quails, as in the meat, isn't described as satisfying the Israelites. It's the manna that is.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool. So I most people seem to think, I mean, when you read books, I've read, what was that? I mean, I've just bought the Psychedelic Gospels, and there was another book. But most people, you're the only person I've really found break it down into being an ergot. And didn't they think that ergot was also what was responsible for the kind of witchy stuff that happened in America with Salem? Some kind of bad bread?
I'm not sure about what happened in Salem, but I wouldn't be surprised. You do get kind of outbreaks of ergotism.
And that comes in bread?
In Europe. Yeah. It's on rye, on various cereals. You know,
and
ergot
And they call manna is referred to as bread sometimes, isn't it? Could it be a sort of molded bread that these people are eating, and then it actually is bread?
That's quite interesting. I mean, bread is generally used as a word for food in general. But yeah, you may be onto something there. I mean, I just want to just kind of correct you on one thing. There's a guy called Dan Merker who wrote a book called The Mystery of Manna, and he was, I think, the first to identify manna as ergot. I hadn't read his book when I identified it as ergot, and some of the information that I've given you there isn't in his book. I wouldn't want to take credit for all of that.
Right. What do you think about Jesus going to India? You ever heard that theory that Jesus went to India?
Yeah, I really like that theory. You know, I haven't looked too deeply into it, but I mean, you know, why not? Jesus went to Japan. There's a place in Japan where they've got this story about it with how his brother died on the cross, and there's a grave there. Jesus came to Glastonbury, apparently. You know, when I was in Brazil one time, walking in the jungle, and there was this really spiky vine. And I asked the guy I was with, I said, what's that vine called? And he says, oh, that's called the Espinhos dos Judeus, which means the spikes of the Jews. And I said, whoa, why do you call it that? And he goes, well, that's the thing that was used on the make the Jesus' crown. Now, if you look at the Middle Eastern traditions, it's not the case, you know, that's acacia sale, which is used. But I quite like the fact that these people had seen a spiky vine and kind of built it into their cosmology. I mean, obviously it's a very anti-Semitic cosmology, which is a little bit challenging. But I, you know, I think we should all take, I think we can all have our own Jesuses, you know, we can all have our own personal Jesuses.
Yeah, I think so too. Why not? I know that in Kashmir...
Mine's much cooler than the guys in Alabama.
Yeah, right? I know in Kashmir they actually have a tomb for Jesus and for Mary. And for Moses, I believe, too.
Moses. They've got them all over the place. You're not much of a nation if you don't have a Jesus tomb somewhere.
Right. What do you think about the Nephilim? Who are these Nephilim, these fallen angels in the Bible, or these beings that came from the heaven to earth?
I don't know, man. Interesting. Like, really, really interesting. But I've got no idea about that one. Well, what do you think?
Well, I only know the conspiracy theory sort of. I never actually read the quotes myself, so I kind of just am hoping they're aliens.
I mean, it'd be nice if they're aliens, wouldn't it? I mean,
it would be really nice. Cool. It'd be the coolest thing ever. Some giant aliens.
It's a lonely planet.
Well, what about aliens? Do you think aliens exist somewhere? And do they worship Jesus?
Well, was Jesus an alien? I mean, like some of those entities that you were talking about before, you know, the things that appear in your head.
Yeah.
They feel quite alien, you know, some
they
of them.
Do feel, like, they do feel, they feel very alien, or like some kind of maybe blend of dimensions where we are sort of, what I think it is, or what I've kind of had the mushroom explain to me, is that we're too distracted by our thoughts all the time. So we're too lost in this world of thoughts, which kind of creates this normal state of consciousness that we work our days through. But when you take a psychedelic or when you do a meditation practice or something like this, some kind of method that slows your thoughts down, it sort of allows you to perceive more information because you're not so distracted by your thoughts. And I think in the psychedelic space that this happens and you sort of some kind of merging of dimensions happens and there's beings that exist there.
Yeah, so I think you're right on that one. I mean, of all the people who seem to think that they've got, you know, probes from alien spacecraft up their bottom, no one's ever actually found a probe up anyone's bottom. So I think the kind of what they call nuts and bolts alien theory is, the evidence for it is a little bit weak, you know. You have to go quite down the conspiracy rabbit hole into kind of futuristic technologies and stuff like that. And even futuristic technologies, they could come from other dimensions. If you look at like Tesla, for example, there's a dude who was walking in the park in Budapest and had a vision of the AC motor and took 500 patents from his life, all of them through visions. You know, the guy never made a blueprint, never made a calculation. So I think, you know, even the advanced technologies, I don't think you need to have flying saucers.
You could even look at technology itself as coming from some kind of from some other dimension, and that I always think about this as technology being some kind of interdimensional alien that's just harnessing our energy through our rituals of capitalism or competition, and it's just sucking our life force out as a way to manifest itself into this physical dimension. So we could be evoking a demon that we just consider technology.
Dude, what was it? There's a line from Eric Davis's book, Technosis, where he talks about every technological advance amputates something. You know, so the car amputates our legs to a degree. You know, like, I remember back in the day, I used to know people's phone numbers. You know, I don't know anyone's phone number anymore. I've got a phone that knows phone numbers on my behalf.
That's kind of interesting, because that would mean that we're slowly progressing towards becoming machines, which if you kind of look at the pattern of what's happening, it seems we're progressing that way into merging with machine worlds.
Well, I think even, and it's not just us, you know, it's like I mean, this is kind of terrifying, but if you look at the orangutan, right? Say the orangutan. Go back 100 years, go back 200 years, almost no one outside of Borneo and Sumatra would have ever seen an orangutan. Very few people would have even heard of them, you know. And, you know, someone shot one and brought it back to the British Museum. People start to see a dead orangutan. And then over, you know, the last 100, 150 years, we learn more about them. We've got video footage of them. We've got them in our zoos. We learn about their gut flora and their social dynamics. People write PhDs on them. And all the time that this information about orangutans is collecting, the actual orangutan population is just being snuffed out slowly by all kinds of pressures. And I find that fascinating. Like, pretty much everyone in the world now knows what an orangutan is, but there's not many of them left. And I get the feeling that we are... Our world is turning into information, like, and that's the only thing that will be, perhaps be the only thing that, you know, on my pessimistic days, is I don't think about this all the time, but I just wonder if we're just collecting a little, you know, like when a plant is about to die, it produces like a flush of beauty, like it puts out loads of flowers, and then it directs all its energy into the seed. You know, we haven't even have this expression, it's going to seed. You know, so it's putting all that information into a hard container which can then last through the winter and regrow somewhere else. So I kind of, you know, when I'm daydreaming sometime, I imagine that the machines will remember us in, and not just us, the entire ecosystem in intricate detail. And perhaps somewhere on another planet, or perhaps on this planet after millions of years have passed and we're in a situation where we can support life again, maybe the machines will kind of put life back together again.
That's an interesting theory. I mean, I could see it. You could see it working out that way. You know, a part of me thinks that biological life can't travel through space, and that's why we don't find any aliens going anywhere. And that's kind of why, to leave the planet, you almost have to create, to become technology to leave the planet. Because I don't know if it's sustainable to travel through space in a body.
Haven't they found, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I understood that some bacteria had gone up to space and then come back again and still been alive.
Yeah, I've heard people say mushrooms can... potentially, like spores can potentially survive in space.
I do. I mean, the guy who knows more about mushrooms than anyone else in the world is Paul Stamets. That's what he thinks.
Does he think he thinks that?
So I, yeah.
Yeah, what a genius.
Know, I wouldn't want to. Exactly. If that guy, if that's what he reckons, I'm not really in a position to argue with him.
Yeah, he's the mushroom man for sure. I loved what he said about how mushrooms dictate sort of orchestrate the environment. I watched that Joe Rogan podcast that he did probably 5 times.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant guy.
Fascinating. Like, mushrooms are completely fascinating. Paul Stamets is pretty fascinating as well, yeah.
What do you think we could communicate with mushrooms, or the reason we do communicate with mushrooms in the way that we do is because we are kind of fungal bodies, that we evolved from these kind of I mean, because fungus mushrooms were the first kind of land life that we find, right, as far as fossils go.
Yeah, indeed. Like, if you look at, like, I think not just mushrooms, you know, like THC, for example, all the various different things that are in cannabis, they're insect repellents, and they have functions that work. They have functions in their world, and they're of us. You know, DMT is another example. We produce DMT, I think, in our lungs. It seems very likely. I don't know if the science is out about this, but we share all sorts with our
which
our
is an interesting case for breathing, for breathing methods.
Yeah, there's this guy, what's his name, Eddie Frexka, who's a Hungarian psychiatrist, and he was the first guy to discover a medical value in DMT. He said it's anti-inflammatory. So when you get into, like, some kind of situation like a car crash, for example, or some kind of massive trauma, according to his theory, your lungs will release a whole load of DMT, and it'll make your blood less likely to clog, which means that you're less likely to have a brain clot, you know? If it doesn't work, you know, if it works, you stay alive. If it doesn't work, then you have some kind of DMT to take you through to the next life.
Yeah, I mean... It's interesting. The afterlife's an interesting thing, because I feel like that's probably what happens when you're dying, is you probably experience something like that. You probably experience some kind of psychedelic trip or some kind of I don't know. It's when I took mushrooms recently in Mexico with these Mazatec people. I was staring at all these different pictures they had of the saints up and stuff like that. They do it kind of through a similar blend of old pagan and Catholic influence now. And the mushroom told me that this space is reserved for those who are dying. And I thought that was an interesting thing to be told from the mushroom. It's like, it was almost what like, space? You're not supposed to be here type of vibe.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it? I like to think in some other daydreams that we get to revisit bits of our lives and spend as much time as we like in certain bits and don't have to deal with the unpleasant bits.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we could be doing that.
Kurt Vonnegut has this idea of he talks about the Trafalmadorians, who are he's kind of American science fiction writer, Kurt Vonnegut, and they experience time, they're aliens, and they experience time in a different way. When they see a person, they see a kind of centipede that begins as a baby and ends up as an old man.
Interesting, yeah.
And so the Trafalmadorians can just move to bits of time which they find more pleasant and not have to deal with bits of time that they don't like.
That's really interesting. I heard enlightenment once explained as being able to relive all moments from all perspectives at once.
Ooh, I think I might feel a bit guilty. All the enemies you've wronged.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that would be fair, though, wouldn't it, somehow?
Yeah, maybe. Do you say it'd be sad?
Yeah, no, it'd be fair. Like, you know, there doesn't seem to be any justice on this planet. But it would be nice if you did have to deal with what you'd done to other people.
Yeah, well, that's another thing.
Maybe it's just
the mushroom also showed me that.
Of mine.
Yeah, no, the mushroom.
Oh, really?
The mushroom showed me once how all these little. Well, it kind of showed me how karma works in the sense that every little small. Maybe I was being a dickhead one day or something like that, and I said something to someone, and it showed me how my sort of intention or the mood I was in. Echoed out into this person's life and sort of grew into maybe an insecurity, or it just showed me this ripple effect that all my actions had onto people. And yeah, I don't know.
I got my mushroom t-shirt on today, look.
Yeah, I know, I see that. That's cool. It's just arrived.
THTC, I used to work for these guys. They're the hemp trading company. They're a hemp company. Working out of England, so I'm ripping their t-shirt.
There's a lot of a big mushroom tradition over there in Europe historically. What do you think about like the fairies and stuff? You think that's that comes from mushroom visions, fairies, and all
maybe.
These gnomes?
I don't know. I mean, who knows if there's a mushroom tradition? We've definitely got a fairy tradition.
Isn't there mushroom traditions that are found in Europe?
It depends where you look. I mean, there's a book called Shroom. What's the guy who wrote it? Andy Letcher wrote a book called Shroom, where he kind of critiques this this perspective, because there isn't any evidence of you know, the first reports of people taking mushrooms are kind of Victorians who think they're being poisoned. You know?
Really? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They're described as intoxication. So maybe we certainly had henbane. We certainly had. Other things that were used for their psychoactive potentials, but whether there was like an indigenous mushroom tradition, doesn't seem to be too much evidence of it.
Okay.
I'm not saying that there isn't, because
right.
You know, a lot of history is written down, you know, so for when the culture was illiterate for such a long time, unless it was church stuff, and even, you know, even the monks were illiterate in 10th century, most of Europe, the monks couldn't, you know, their Latin was almost unreadably bad, you know. So that's why they call it the Dark Ages. You know, we had this whole period where we don't know what happened because no one could really write. So we don't know.
Cool. Well, we did about an hour. Is there anything else that you want to release to these people of the world?
Find your book? My book. Thank you for mentioning that. So that's my book. It's called Neuroapocalypse. That's my second book. So that you can get on Amazon, for example. My first book's called Science Revealed, which is currently out of print, but when my publisher pulls his finger out and does the proofread, then the second edition of that is coming out. And then what else? I'm talking at Breaking Convention in, a couple of months in England. I'm talking at the Girona Ayahuasca Conference. That's quite soon. That's at the end of, I think it's at the end of this month. If I'm not mistaken, that's going to be a really good one. If anyone's interested in ayahuasca, get yourselves to Girona. It's the ICERS conference. And then what else? You can check out Psychedelic Press, which is my publisher. They've got a bunch of articles by me, and there's a load of podcast on YouTube, and my Twitter handle is Rev Nemu. So that's RevNemu. And I do want to say one more thing, which I think is quite important for psychedelic people. And I often say this, but in my tradition, right, the Daimi tradition, we are forbidden from proselytizing and we're forbidden from doing propaganda and saying how wonderful it is. So I like the fact that we are enthusiastic about psychedelics. I'm obviously enthusiastic about them. But I think if we have a kind of missionary bent to how we do things, then the best way for us to be advocates of psychedelics is by being as cool and as moral and as sound as possible, rather than telling people they need to take drugs.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think psychedelics it's a real serious thing. That it's, well, not only one can it be, you know, mentally sort of difficult, but yeah, it's a journey. It's something that demands respect, and I think tradition, doing it in a tradition, is important, at least to me. You know, that's why I've gone to Mexico and kind of done my seeking and stuff like that. So I agree with that message. I think that you should take psychedelics seriously. It's not something that you should just take at in a trailer park somewhere with your friends.
I mean, you can still giggle. Oh, I must ask, actually, in this Mazatec ceremony, yeah, were people giggling on mushrooms as well?
Well, it was just me. It was just me, an old lady, and my friend, and we were just in a different dimension for the most part. But I think giggling's all right. Giggling can be healing. I think it's
great. I just wonder. Yeah, I just wonder if this curandera's giggle.
No, she wasn't giggling. She's a really old lady. She doesn't even speak Spanish. She speaks Mazatec. So we can hardly communicate with her. But I was surprised. We did it at night, and she's got to be pushing 90 years old. And she held space for about 7 hours, just chanting and keeping this copal lit and just, you know, busting out this ceremony. I was really impressed. I couldn't understand anything she said, but it was impressively deep.
Yeah, you had the mushroom to talk to.
Yeah, I had the mushroom to talk to. But yeah, thanks so much.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, I've been so keen to have you on here for a long time. I hope we can do it again. I'd like to have you as a reoccurring guest on my YouTube and podcast. Maybe we can figure out.
Hit me up.
Yeah, we'll figure out a way to make this a little bit more better quality. But yeah, I love this conversation, and I love the work you do, and I love the knowledge that you bring to people. You don't find too many people that are interested in the kind of stuff that you're interested in. So I think you are a well of knowledge, and I'm happy to be associated with you.
Thank you very much. You're making me blush.
Cool. Make sure to go check him out, guys. I talk about you a lot I think I mentioned you in my podcast a couple times and on my live stream. So yeah, check out him. Check out Reverend Danny Nemu and his books on Amazon, or his book. And much love, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Thanks a lot.
Boom.
Cool. Should I turn this guy off? That was fun.